Mr. Macy, reel 7.
Now, as I said earlier, Captain Rogger did disobey orders which he had received from the German High Command in Berlin. Now, one of the orders which he received was that when Red Cross parcels were served out, the contents of the parcels should all be emptied into a bowl. Now, imagine tins of herring in, tea, custard powder, biscuits, Nestle's milk, sugar, salt, pepper, and so on and so forth, all tipped into one bowl. Well, he apparently, conveniently, forgot about this for a long time until Shoof and his boys picked him up, and he had no recourse but to obey orders and have all the contents of the parcels tipped into the bowl. Admittedly, the Germans who were in the Red Cross parcel store did, as far as possible, put them in separate little heaps in the bowl so that you could empty at least the larger part of, say, a tin of Nestle's milk or a pound jar of jam or tin of jam and things like that into another tin when you got back to your hut. They did their best in that respect. I'll give them their due there. Now, the reason why this order was sent from Berlin was because it had been discovered that messages had been written on the backs of the labels of the tins by the people back home in UK here who were packing them. Messages telling them how the war was going and that sort of thing. The Gestapo had picked it up. That was the reason for the order. But as you can imagine, it was one hell of a mess trying to sort this lot out. Now, heating in the huts. We had slow combustion stoves in there, and we had a ration of 10 briquettes a day for each stove. That was one per room. Now, these 10 briquettes were nothing more than coal dust and cement all mixed up, put in a mould, and so you got like a small brick. It was about 10 inches long, I suppose, by about 3 inches wide and about 2 inches deep. That was our fuel for the day. And it had to keep us warm in the winter and also cook our food for our evening meal. There was a petty officer in my room who was a Grimsby fisherman, Petty Officer Phil Gooder. Now, he taught me how to make fishermen's nets. And this was a good thing because when I'd made the net, I nailed it onto my bunk and it became a nice little spring. So instead of laying on bare boards with a mattress of straw, I had a nice little net spread over it and the mattress on top of that, and I was really comfortable in my bunk. When I did it, so did the others. And as a matter of fact, I've still got that fisherman's needle today that I made those nets with. But I can't make the nets anymore, I've forgotten. Once a week in Marlag, we were taken up to the bathhouse, which was near the Dulag compound, for a hot bath. As you see, as I've said before, naval people always keep themselves clean and use plenty of water. This was a naval camp. A bathhouse was laid on so that we could have a hot bath every week. But now, while we were there, we had been getting reports of the gas chambers, the bathhouses, the white tiles, the rose in the ceiling, the gas coming through.
Who told you of this?
I forget who told us, but we got the information that this was going on. gas chambers. Now, when we went up to the bathhouse the first time, we began to wonder, because it was exactly the same. The white tile walls and deckhead, the rose in the ceiling. The doors were shut, and we wondered what was coming out of those roses. Fortunately, every time it was water. But knowing that this was going on in Germany, it did make one feel a little wary and a little uncomfortable. Another thing that used to happen in Marlag was the heads there was just a sort of outhouse with a row of seats along it on brick, a sort of low brick wall. Now, this had to be emptied out every few days, and a cart with a cylinder on it used to come into the camp, which we called Smelly Nelly, and the hose was run from that down into the heads. The urine and excreta was all extracted into the cylinder, the cart rumbled away, and it was all taken out and put on the farms in the vicinity of the camp, which was where our veg was grown. Radios. We had radios in this camp, and at the time I was there, we had 7 radios, only one of which was used at a time, of course. The others were all hidden. But from time to time, the Germans used to come in searching for them. They knew that we got them, but they couldn't find them except on very rare occasions. Well, now, the radios were used for listening to the 6 o'clock BBC news every night. And in every hut, there was a news hand. And he used to go along to the hut in which the news had been taken down from the 6 o'clock news. And he would write it down on a pad or in a notebook. And then he would go back to his own hut and go from room to room telling them what the latest news was. Now, I was the news hand in my hut. And I was in a more fortunate position than the rest of them, because I used to take it down in shorthand, which I could do very well then and read very well. Not so hot at it now, but I could then. And I used to take it back and, as I said, read it to all the lads in the hut. There used to be a lot of bartering going on with the guards, mainly for bottles of brandy and wine and that sort of thing. You've got to remember that when the Germans went into France, they scuppered up all the wines and brandies and hoops that they could lay their hands on and transported it into Germany, and it was served out to commanding officers of various German establishments and also to commandants of prisoner of war camps, as we discovered. So I could speak the lingo pretty well. I studied it, and I used to talk to the German guards, and I got on with it much better than I did Italian. So I was detailed off to do the bartering down at the gate at night with the German guards for mainly bottles of drink. Now, the bottles of drink used to change hands mainly for one of 4 currencies: soap, cigarettes, chocolate and coffee. That was the currency. Now, the particular people that I got mixed up with as a result of my singing activities, they'd been in captivity since early 1940. Their cigarette parcels and clothing parcels came through regularly. They got lots of them. They were always well stocked with cigarettes. So they used to give me the cigarettes. I used to do the bartering, get the wines and spirits and take them back. And by talking to the guards and doing the bartering, I learned even more German. I was getting quite good at it. We also made our own booze, or jungle juice as we used to call it. In the camp were some Norwegian sailors, and in their Red Cross parcels they used to get a lot of dried fruit. I don't know why they got it and we didn't, but they did. Well, now, dried fruit was just the job for making wine with. We got hold of a sauerkraut barrel. We got potatoes that we could spare, and we got dried fruit and anything else that would ferment. Put it down in the sauerkraut barrel. Dug a hole, put the sauerkraut barrel in it, and let it ferment for about a month. Then we took it out, and the chief EA off the submarine SEAL, who was in the camp, had made a still, but he'd made a double still. And when the wine had finished fermenting, it was taken up out of the ground, strained off from the sauerkraut barrel, put through the still twice, and out the other end came just about 98% pure alcohol. This was all bottled, and a little gang of us, in true naval tradition, at top time, 11 o'clock every morning, we used to go down to the Hauptführer's room, in my particular hut, and we all had a little top of hooch at 11 o'clock.
Did you dilute it?
Some did, some didn't. It wasn't really necessary. It was just like, well, looking at gin, really. I never used to dilute mine. Most of us didn't, actually, because we were all senior rates and used to drinking our rum neat, because it was served to us neat. Once you became a chief or a petty officer, you had neat rum, which is where you get the neaters from, as opposed to the lower rates, leading seamen and below, getting one measure of rum and two measures of water.
Grog.
Hmm. So we used to make our own hooch. Now, rations of meat. We used to get a ration of meat from the Germans every so often. But when the 1,000 plane raids started to take place on Bremen and Hamburg, we seemed to get far more rations of meat. And we always seemed to get a ration of meat about a couple of days after there'd been a damn great raid on Bremen or Hamburg. And we discovered it was horse meat. It was very similar to eating beef, and it was quite nice. So, really and truly, the air raids helped us out in one way, because we got bigger meat rations. Now, I remember one night there was a big raid going on Bremen, and they really were big raids. The sky used to be lit up, not only with the searchlights, but with the fires in Bremen and the flares which our own people used to drop, the Pathfinders, I believe they were called, to lead the planes in. And one night I was standing outside of our hut, looking at the bombing going on at Bremen, and the light was so bright that I nipped into the hut and got a German newspaper, Allgemeine Zeitung, and I took it outside, and believe it or not, with the light from Bremen, I could read that newspaper 15 kilometres away. Which I think is quite something. Now, you've heard me say that we had a fire reservoir there. Well, in the winter, this used to freeze over. So we thought, well, we could make a skating rink out of this. How are we going to make the skates? Well, not too much of a problem, really. There are always odd blocks of wood laying around. Some of us got some blocks of wood. Roughly fashioned them into the shape of a foot. The next thing was the blades for the skates. This wasn't too much of a problem because there were adjusting struts on the bars on the windows. So we took those off and sharpened them up a bit and fixed them to the blocks of wood, which were tied on to our feet with Red Cross string again, and we had some remarkably good skates that we could go skating on the fire reservoir with. So that helped to pass an hour or two away in the winter. Appels, we had those twice a day. But when the Germans were looking for anything or thought we'd been bad boys and that sort of thing, they would have appels at any time of the day or night. And if we had been bad boys and they'd discovered a radio or something that we shouldn't have had, or done some other thing that they didn't like, they used to stand us outside on the, well, you might call it parade ground, for 2 or 3 hours at a time, no matter what the weather. And the only saving grace about that was that if it was in the winter and we were damn cold, then so too were they, and they were just as miserable as we were. Radios were built by the communications ratings in the camp, and they were made by getting the guards, who went on leave from time to time, to buy bits and pieces of radios, wires, valves, things like that. They brought them in, and the usual soap, chocolate, coffee or cigarettes changed hands for the bits and pieces they brought back. And so, over a period of time, the radio was built up. And the same thing happened with crockery. In order to make life a little more comfortable and a little more civilised for ourselves, when we knew that a guard was going on leave, we would get him to bring back some cups and saucers or plate, china ones, so that we could be, as I say, just that little bit more civilised. And of course the usual currency applied. Now, guard dogs were turned into the camp from time to time, and they were trained in a run along parallel with the wire on one side of the camp. They were trained with British Army battle dress, and they were ferocious beasts, and at night they would come in with their handlers any time during the night, just to make sure that everything was all right. Or if the Germans were going to do a search, then the dogs would be brought in as well. Now, one of the petty officer telegraphists reckoned that he could tame one of these dogs. So bets were flying all over the place that he couldn't. So one day, when the dogs were brought in, he had a couple of tots of Dutch courage, and he put a bar of chocolate in his pocket, and he went outside of the hut to where there was a handler and his dog approaching, and he got down on all fours, and he crawled towards this dog, growling and snarling and gnashing his teeth and one thing and the other. And the poor old dog was a bit nonplussed with this. He started backing away, and he was growling and gnashing his teeth and barking and that sort of thing. And his tail was between his legs. And the poor old handler, he couldn't make out what the devil was going on. However, Sparks kept crawling forward until he got right up to the dog. I was still growling away, one at the other. And then he put his hand in his pocket, took out the chocolate, took it out of the wrapper, and coaxed the dog with it. And the dog took it, so he gave him another piece. In fact, he gave him the whole bar, by which time the dog's tail was going, the handler, he was completely put off. He just didn't know what to do. He dragged the dog with him and cleared off out of the camp. He couldn't take any more. And Sparks won his bets, of course. Now, after the war, there was a film made called The Captive Heart. It was about prisoners of war, and from an interest point of view, it was made in Marlag, as was another film called Albert R.N. Now, you may have read the book, you may have seen the film on television, or you may have seen it in the cinema, Albert R.N. This was an escape which the officers did. They made a dummy of a naval officer, and they took this dummy up to the bathhouse with them. But it wasn't all assembled. It was in bits and pieces. And what happened was that when the officers were in the bathhouse and dressing after the bath, the one who was going to escape hid in a toilet up there. Albert was hastily assembled. And when the officers got outside for counting, Albert was in the middle of them. So the Germans went along, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and so on. And Albert was counted. The other chap was in the toilet, left behind in the bathhouse. As soon as everybody cleared off, of course, he was away. Now, they used this, I think, about 3 times before the Germans discovered what was going on. And, as I say, there was a film made of it, and it was made at Marlag. There was another attempted escape in the early days from Marlag. I think it was in 1940. Some of the submariners, and one of them was the captain of the SEAL, the submarine SEAL. They started to dig a tunnel from under the galley in the officers' compound. And they got outside of the perimeter wires before it was discovered. But it was discovered, unfortunately, for them. So that this made the Germans dig a moat all the way round the perimeter of Marlag to prevent any further tunnelling. It was the only camp I was ever in where there was a moat round it. And you've got to remember that both in Italy and in Germany, prisoner of war camps were built on sandy soil as a prevention against tunnelling. Now, towards the end of the war, that is in the winter of 44-45, fuel was very short in Germany, and our supply of briquettes dried up. So we had to think of an alternative fuel. Now, not far away from the camp was a small wood made up of pine and larches mostly. Now, the majority of this had been felled, and the roots were still left in the earth. So it was decided by Captain Rogger that we would go out there and get the roots out of the ground and use those as fuel in place of briquettes. So every day, working parties went out to these woods armed with axes, crowbars, chains, ropes, pickaxes, and sledgehammers, and little dog carts. And we dug the roots of these trees out, loaded them up into the carts, and carted them back into the camp, where they were further split down with steel wedges and sledgehammers, and used in the galley and served out to the rooms in the huts. Now, while I was there, an escape attempt was made from the ratings compound. And one day, when I was in the theatre, I was asked if I would like to join in. So I discussed with those concerned exactly what form this escape was going to take. And I asked them whether it had been through the escape committee in the officers' compound, and it hadn't. So after thinking about it for a day or two, I turned it down because I didn't think it was going to work. How right I was, but not in the way that you would expect me to be right. I will explain. There were 10 of them going. Wire cutters were made in the theatre. They were going to make the break on a night when there was an air raid on Bremen or Hamburg or both. Now, under the Geneva Convention, one of the things which your captors had to do in a prisoner of war camp was to leave all the lights turned on to show those up above in the aircraft that you were a prisoner of war camp. But in Germany, well, in Marlag anyway, whenever there was an air raid, all the lights were turned off, completely contrary to the Geneva Convention agreement. So, this escape was due to take place on an air raid night. Duly, everything was prepared, the wire cutters were all ready, they got all their gear ready, these 10 chaps, and they decided on a night if an air raid should take place. Now, I think this was in the summer of 1944 that this took place, yes. And I knew exactly what was happening, and I knew the time that they were going, 10 o'clock at night, provided the lights were out. So at 10 o'clock on this particular night, the air raid was laid on, all the lights had been out for some time, and I heard boots moving up the corridor of the hut, and I thought, well, they're underway. They went up across the football pitch, what we call a football pitch anyway, up to the wire at the far end, top end of the camp. And knowing that they were going, I opened the window, put our lights out and opened the window. Sorry, our lights were already out. I opened the window. And I stood at the window, and it wasn't long before I heard a ping. I thought, God almighty, if I can hear the wire being cut, surely the Jerry's in the goon boxes can. But no, nothing happened. A few seconds after that, bing! And now, bing! And so it went on for about 5 minutes. The wire was stretched so tight, as it was cut, it was springing back with this ping. Now, in German prison camps, there were 3 vertical sets of wire. In between each set of wire was rolls of barbed wire. However, they cut through this lot. The next thing is really rather funny, because it just goes to prove that anyone making an escape, no matter how well laid his plans are, it is 99.9% luck which gets him out of a camp. Everything went quiet after the pings for a period, and then suddenly all hell was let loose. The guards came in, the dogs came in, everything was going on. And we wondered what the blazes could have happened. It wasn't long before I heard thump, thump, thump of boots down the corridor of our hut, door banging. In rushed the guards. And they said the power was going to be taken. Now, you've got to remember, this was about 11 o'clock at night. So, they duly came round, and they took a Pell, and they found that no one was missing. No one was. The next morning I set out to find out what on earth could have happened. I went up to the wire where I knew the hole was being cut. And there, lo and behold, was a whacking great hole that you could have got a wheelbarrow through.